Copper and Brass Incorporated, founded by Paul Revere in 1801. Fabricators of copper, copper alloys, and aluminum alloys for home and industry, and makers of the famous Revere ware, presents Meet the Press. Our guest for this afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, will be Anthony Eden, former Foreign Minister of Great Britain. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air. Ready for this afternoon's unrehearsed, spontaneous press conference of the air are four of America's top reporters. Please remember that their questions do not necessarily reveal their point of view. It is their way of getting a story for you. Now meet Mr. Marquis Childs of United Features. Mr. Alistair Cook of the Manchester Guardian of England. Mr. Herbert Matthews of the New York Times. Mr. Lawrence Bivak of Mercury Publications and a regular member of the Meet the Press panel. And finally, Miss Martha Roundtree, moderator of Meet the Press.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, members of the press panel, and our very special guest, Mr. Anthony Eden. Mr. Eden, we have so many questions to ask you, we're not going to take the time now to tell you how pleased we are at this opportunity to interview you. I think we'll let Mr. Cook have the first question.
Mr. Eden, would you like to say for an American audience why, in the British view, there is no contradiction between a country which is a monarchy, which has a socialist government, and which is a democracy?
Well, as we see it, you see, we elect our governments at home on a basis of universal franchise. And the monarchy is not only something we respect and look up to, it's much more than that, of course. It is the link, one of the chief links, which binds the whole Commonwealth together. And you can have the monarchy, whether it's a socialist government or a Tory government or a liberal government. It makes no difference.
Mr. Childs.
Clayton, you've been touring America now for about a month. I wonder if many Americans have asked you whether or not there was any point in our putting these billions of dollars into Western Europe, and what did you tell them if they did?
I have had that suggestion put to me once or twice, yes. And I told them I thought martial aid had probably saved Western Europe. And you can see evidence of it not only in the free part of Western Europe, but behind the Iron Curtain, too, in countries like Austria.
In that connection, Mr. Eden, you are apparently getting into difficult financial waters again for one reason or another in Great Britain. And I noticed that at the end of this year, the first payment is coming up on that debt of the loan of 5 years ago from the United States, $4 billion. Do you think that Britain can make that payment, or should it be funded or something?
Well, maybe we are getting into difficulties, but if so, it's mainly because of rearmament. Because owing to our rearmament program, we are buying more raw materials at higher prices. And we're producing less for export. And that is putting the terms of trade against us.
Would you foresee that payment of, I think it's 70 million interest and 50 million principal on December 31st, would you foresee a request to postpone that?
I wouldn't foresee that at present. I don't know enough about the latest figures. And I think the terms of trade could well turn our way again, supposing the raw materials we produce began to go up in price again.
Remember, Lord Keynes said that should have been a gift all along and not a loan. Would you have agreed with that?
Well, that would be for the United States to say, and not for me.
Mr. Matthews.
Mr. Eden, I think a lot of us here think in terms of helping a socialist government. Now, when it comes to the welfare state, your party is just about the same as the socialist. You are for socialized medicine, for social services of every kind, for full employment, economic planning. Your foreign policy is very much the same as the socialist government. It's hard for Americans to see the difference between the Tory party to which you belong and the Labour party. Can you explain that?
If it's hard for Americans to see that difference, you know, it's sometimes hard for us to see the differences between the parties in your country. But of course, there are differences, and the main one is on the issue of nationalisation. Broadly speaking, the socialists stand for more state ownership and control of industry. We stand for less. A particular issue which you know has much agitated our politics has been iron and steel, which this government have nationalized and which we strongly, and the Liberal Party, strongly oppose.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Eden, what would be your party's first step if you came into power?
Well, now, I don't want to go into the details of domestic politics because we don't when we're abroad as a rule. But one of the things we're pledged to, and this is public knowledge, is to revoke the nationalization of the steel industry, restore it to free enterprise again. We are pledged to that.
Do you think you can unscramble that egg?
Well, if we didn't think so, we wouldn't have pledged ourselves to it.
Mr. Eden, one of the things one of the questions that's been raised in this country often is this. That the Marshall Plan aid kept your socialist experiment alive. Do you think that that was so?
I regard the Marshall Plan aid as aid to Europe. And I don't regard it as aid to any political party. As you know, we revoked that aid about a year ago or more. Not because we weren't grateful, but because we all thought we ought to stand on our own feet as soon as we possibly could.
You don't think, then, that the Marshall Plan subsidized the socialist experiment in England?
No, sir, that would not be my view. You have to look broader than political parties sometimes, to national conception.
Would it have been possible, though, if you hadn't have had Marshall Plan aid?
If we hadn't had Marshall Plan aid, we would have had 2 million unemployed. And that would have been a pretty serious thing for our country and for Europe.
Mr. Eden, in your speech in Denver, you called, and I quote, for a continuing association between the United States and Britain, a true brotherhood, intimate and unselfish. Now, do you think that recognition of the Chinese communists and trading with Russia and her satellites contribute toward the true brotherhood, intimate and unselfish?
Well, there are bound to be differences. I think, if I may say so, Mr. Spivak, the most important you touched on is this question of trade with Russia. And I think we've got to make up our minds whether we want to see East-West trade or not. Personally, I think there must be some, because if we don't trade with Russia, it merely means more demands upon you. Also, we need timber, for instance, from Russia for our housing. And you know that housing is the gravest domestic problem we have at home at the present time.
Why can't you get that timber from Canada?
Get some from Canada, and of course we'd like to get more. There you run into the dollar problem.
Well, but do you think it's wise to trade with someone who's trying to destroy you, especially when some of that trade helps them, like shipping machinery to them?
Ah, we don't. There's a list of 200 items or more which we do not ship to Soviet Russia. In particular, we don't ship jigs and tools and machinery which would be useful for the conduct of war.
Well, isn't it true that until recently you shipped some locomotives?
I don't think for some time any important locomotives. But I haven't, I'm afraid, the details. Broadly, I think East-West trade should be continued, subject to careful regulation that you don't build up the war potential. Otherwise, if we stop it, it puts a still heavier burden on the economies of the free countries.
Now, you're shipping rubber to Russia, I understand. Now, that certainly can be used for military purposes.
Yes, I understand. Of course, I'm not a member of the government. I'm only answering what I hear. I'm told. I understand that the shipments are limited in quantity, and certainly have not been increased in recent years. It's been kept down to a low level.
Well, if they're limited in quantity, and you're getting a limited amount of material in return, why don't you get it somewhere else instead of irritating an ally as you are irritating us?
Well, if you'll tell us where to get it from, we'd be glad to find it. I don't know the place.
Can you answer that, Mr.
You
Spivak?
You think you can't get timber and grain and meat anywhere but Russia?
I think we need the Russian timber, grain and meat badly to keep the economy of the West going. It's not any question of us. It's, of course, other Western countries, too.
Can you get meat, for example, from Argentina? And can't you get grain
from
Russia?
We get some meat from Argentina. Not as much as we would like. Our meat ration is very low, as you know.
You're saying, then, Mr. Eden, that it's absolutely essential for you to go on trading with Russia. What do you do if you get into war with Russia?
I think it is desirable, in present circumstances, to maintain some East-West trade. I think it's in the general interest of the Western countries, including ourselves. Yes, I do.
Mr. Charles.
Mr. Eden, do you think that Britain is prepared to sign the Japanese treaty, and what do you think of that peace settlement with Japan?
As far as I know, she's ready to sign it, and it seems to me that Mr. Dulles has done a good job of work, and it's a pretty good treaty as far as I can judge.
What do you think about Nehru's attitude on this whole problem?
Well, I'm sorry that the government of India aren't going to sign it too. I think it's a pity, but of course it's for them to decide it.
What do you think's the explanation of Nehru?
Well, it may be in part this policy is pursued of not wishing to commit himself completely with the West or with any other bloc of powers.
wouldn't his policy result in a power vacuum in Japan that would be filled by communism, inevitably?
Well, I think it's right to have the treaty, so that's my view. I'm sorry it's not his.
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Eden, harking back to Mr. Childs, possible coming economic difficulties in Great Britain. American correspondents have been reporting in the last week or two that since the two parties are so evenly divided, a lot of people are beginning to feel that the only party that could take strong and unpopular measures would be a coalition. How do you feel, and how does the Conservative Party feel about a coalition?
I don't much like discussing our domestic politics, even with so friendly a person as you, Mr. Cook, who knows them so well. I'd only say the differences, I think, are deeper, as seen from Britain, than perhaps they're seen from here, particularly on the nationalisation I mentioned.
Mr. Matthews.
I'd like to get back, Mr. Eden, to the question Mr. Spivak asked.
Mm.
It always puzzles Americans to know why Britain keeps on recognizing communist China after all that's happened. Can you explain that?
Well, I was not myself, nor was Mr. Churchill, in favor of the particular moment which we chose for recognition. We don't regard recognition as carrying any approval of a government you recognize. We regard it as merely a practical arrangement. So I'm in some difficulty in answering your question. I would have preferred not to do it then, at any rate not before the Colombo Conference, and I would wish to be in agreement with you.
Well, Mr. Eden, do you recognize a government that you're fighting with? Don't you break off diplomatic relations with a government that you're at war with?
It seems that often happens in my experience, yes.
Well, isn't it true that you're virtually at war with the Chinese communists today? Haven't you got a Commonwealth division fighting in Korea?
We must
just as we have?
We most certainly have a Commonwealth division in Korea. Well, I think it's easy to exaggerate the importance of the recognition issue either one way or the other, myself.
Well, why, sir, would you recognize a country with which you're fighting?
I didn't recognize you, see.
No, I mean England. I'm speaking about England and you're...
Well,
you then would be against the recognition.
I thought it was a mistake to do it at that time. And why I thought it a mistake, I quite understood, I think, the reasons which led many people to want to do it. That's to say, the acceptance of a fact, whether liked or not liked. But I didn't want to do it then just because I fear the result might be we should get out of step.
Well,
and we have got out of step.
It was a mistake to recognize. And do you think it would be a good idea now to break off the
diplomatic relations? I don't think you'll get very much out of that either one way or the other. I don't think it'll make the slightest difference.
Difference to whom?
To anybody.
You mean if the English broke off diplomatic relations?
As things are now.
No difference to anybody?
I wouldn't have thought as things are today. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that we're in the Korean campaign and our troops are there fighting alongside yours.
And you think it has no propaganda value at all?
I think it's easy to exaggerate it.
Isn't it true, Mr. Cook, that the Chinese communist government doesn't recognize you? They haven't received the British ambassador, have they, yet?
Oh, we have. I believe we have somebody there. We have a charge
about
that.
But he hasn't been received, I think.
He's had contacts with the government, with whom I don't know.
Mr. Charles.
Sweden, there seems to be considerable opposition in Britain to including Spain in the Atlantic Defense Pact. What is your explanation for that opposition?
I would say that the opposition is not so much to making an arrangement about bases. If the United States wanted to make an arrangement about bases... But there certainly would be opposition to the pact, to Spain joining the Atlantic Pact. I think that being partly because of the preamble to the pact, which, as you know, lays down that the countries who are members must be democracies and have free parliaments.
But except we include Portugal, don't we?
Yes, there is further difficulty about Spain. You've got to keep the psychology, and you know it very well, Mr. Charles, better than me, probably the background of this story. And no doubt there are many people in Europe who fear that you and we may be thinking of defending Europe on the Channel or on the Pyrenees. And it's important that they shouldn't get any encouragement for that thought.
Would your party, the Conservative Party, have about the same attitude toward that?
I think what Mr. Churchill said was that we would understand an arrangement about bases, but I don't think we would be enthusiastic to alter the preamble to the Atlantic Pact at this time.
And how does that apply to Greece and Turkey, or would you be...
No. Greece and Turkey, we would have liked a Middle Eastern pact. But that's too difficult now with the troubles between Israel and the Arab state.
We'd like a separate Middle East.
We would have liked it. But since you can't get that, I think it's only fair and reasonable to bring Greece and Turkey into the Atlantic Pact.
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Eden, you said earlier that the Marshall Plan was aid to Europe and not to any political party in Britain, for instance. A lot of people in this country feel that since the plight of Europe is a continental plight.
Yes.
That too much sovereignty is a luxury which the American people can't afford to pay for. How do you feel, in other words, about federal union?
Well, we're in a different position in that respect, I consider, to the rest of Europe. As the rest of Europe is concerned, we are in favor of closer arrangements, and we'd like, up to a point, to be associated with them. But we're also the heart and center of the Commonwealth and Empire. And there could be no question, therefore, so far as we're concerned, of a federation that was limited to Europe, as I see it.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Eden, I don't quite understand this. In your speech in Chicago, and this comes back to what you've just said, you said we have got somehow to take the sting out of nationalism.
Yes.
And yet the English have been the stumbling block in many ways to the Schuman Plan and the Council of Europe. Now, how are you going to take the sting out of nationalism if you insist on being so nationalistic?
Well, I wouldn't say that the English have been the stumbling block, I don't think, Mr. Spivak, altogether. We have sometimes criticized our government's attitude to the Council of Europe, but one has to recognize that our position is not the same as that of a continental power in Europe. However much we may favor the Schuman Plan, for instance, we are not in the same position as France, Germany, or Belgium, because our interests are across the Atlantic and around the world as much as they are European.
Well, why? I don't quite understand why that should make any difference.
Well, it makes a difference to your closer association with one particular group. In other words, much British thought, I would say, spans the Atlantic quite as much as it's European.
Well, do you mean by that that the Australians and the Canadians might object if Great Britain wanted to do something with a federated Europe?
I'm not saying that, but I don't think British opinion would be ripe for federation with Europe today. I don't think so. Closer relations, yes, but federation, no.
Isn't it true that when England was in great difficulty and France was fallen, that Mr. Churchill asked France for what amounted to practically a federation?
He offered France very close relations, and we would be ready for close relations now. But federation is another issue. See, we are both a European power and a world power. And we think that the empire and commonwealth part of our life comes before everything else.
Well,
many
of us. Did the empire object at that time when you were in trouble to having a very close union with France?
It isn't a question of the empire objecting. It's a question of what the British people themselves would wish to do.
Well, did the British people object at that time?
To their particular offer, no. But that was an offer made and never defined and, of course, not accepted. But I'm all for closer relations with Europe, but only as far as they do not conflict with closer empire and commonwealth relations, which is where I think we can make our chief contribution.
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Eden, does it work the other way around? I was thinking that, do you think there'll be complaints in Britain about the Australians and New Zealanders signing a separate defense pact with the United States?
No, I'm very glad you mentioned that, Mr. Cook. Not at all. We were delighted, and we welcomed it. But, of course, we are in that too. Not in terms, but by our unwritten constitution. That to say, if Australia or New Zealand were attacked, we would, of course, at once be at war. No pact is needed to make that clear.
Mr. Charles.
Mr. Eden, having been over here for a month now, what do you think about this? Do you think we want to make war against Russia? Have you seen terrible martial spirit evident over here?
No, I have not. And I really have been encouraged by the friendliness of what we at home would call the man in the street. I've been through the Middle West. I've thought, don't you call it down to the grassroots, where people are really friendly?
I'd like to ask your opinion. In your opinion, will a Third World War break out in the next 12 months? Is there a likelihood of it? How does it weigh up?
I think as I see it from the European angle, looking from Europe for the moment, I would say the chances were less than they were a year ago. Chances of war are less than they were a year ago.
Do you think we're more apprehensive about it over here than you are there?
If anything, I should say you were.
What's your explanation?
Well, because I think in Europe, strength is beginning to develop, though it's far from what we want. Confidence is beginning to return. I think Eisenhower has done a magnificent job in reviving a sense of that there's a chance of winning through. You see, Europe doesn't much want to be liberated. It would like to be defended, and if it feels it can be defended, it'll take part in it, do all it can itself.
Mr. Matthews.
In connection with that, the United States is now, we feel, the champion of the democratic world. Great Britain has had a hard time of it lately and has had to take a second place. How do they feel in Great Britain about the United States pushing into the Near East, into fields that the British used to monopolize and dominate?
My friend,
jealousy?
Not a bit. We are ready to work with you 100% wherever you like. And you do know England well. There's nothing of that kind in our people's thoughts. And Americans at home forget as warm a welcome even as you've given me here. Come, put it hard, man.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Eden, there's been a great deal of debate on this side on the wisdom of the Yalta secret agreement, in which your government, I believe, took some part. Do you think Yalta was a mistake? Or do you agree with those who say that if we hadn't paid the price Russia asked at Yalta, she would have taken more?
You mean the particular the Far Eastern Agreement, I suppose?
Yes.
Well, that is the matter which Stettinius deals with in his book and explains what our attitude was. It would take a long time to go into it there. As regards the general position, the great failure has been to fulfill, of course, the engagements entered into at Yalta. And I believe that there never will be any kind of confidence between East and West until the Russians carry out the engagements they've made.
George, you think the Yalta agreement was all right, but that it wasn't lived up to?
I think some of it was all right. The bits I didn't like are described in Mr. Stettinius's book. I won't worry you with it now.
Have you been behind the Iron Curtain recently, Mr. Eden?
No. Last year, I motored through the Russian zone in Austria, and I saw there, rather to my surprise, notices saying this factory has been rebuilt thanks to martial aid. I thought that was encouraging. Or accidental, I don't know which.
Mr. Charles.
Mr. Eden, on this Middle East thing, a great many people here seem to feel that the Labour government has badly mishandled this Iranian oil thing. What is your rule? You know the Middle East very well, I know.
Well, you know our rule. We don't criticize our government abroad. I think a fair offer was made to the Persians. It was a 50% offer. Just about the same as your Saudi Arabian offer. Perhaps it wasn't as well presented. Perhaps public relations in Tehran aren't awfully easy.
Wasn't it presented rather too late, Mr.
Well, it's about 2 years ago, you know, that the offer was made. It took a pretty long time to seep through. I don't think Tehran is the easiest place in which to explain offers either.
There are now British troops stationed on Cyprus. Do you think sending them in to protect Abadan would be a risk that should be taken?
That's one I wouldn't like to go into now. I'd like to know a good deal more about what's going on than I do. Mm. I've been away from home for 6 weeks.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Eden, in your speech in Chicago, you said that the Atlantic Pact, in your judgment, is inadequate to protect the Western world from the challenge of communism. Is that correct?
Well, it's something like that. It's a good question. May I say what I had in mind?
What else would you have us do?
Well, what I have in mind is this. I'm not sure that we've got the priorities worked out all over the world. The Atlantic Pact covers one area very well. But then there's the Far East, for instance. Where is Indochina in your order of priorities? Our order of priorities. Where is Malaya in our order of priorities? All those things seem to me to need to be worked out. And that's what I meant by an overall...
Well, when you mean priorities, you mean troops?
Well,
and
even supplies.
Arms and supplies.
Even supplies, yes. Exactly that. I mean, supply of aircraft is to be made, by whom, by you or by us, to assist the French in Indochina, how much do they need, how much should we send there, how is the situation in Malaya developing? It seems to me it's all one problem, equally with the Atlantic problem.
I don't like to harp on this, but don't you think it would help a little bit if we stopped trading with the enemy too, though?
Well, we have stopped as far as China goes completely, absolutely and completely. Nothing can go into Hong Kong except under license. That is a complete tie-up. I don't think you need have any doubt about that one.
One swift question, Mr. Charles.
When are you going to have your election in Britain, and who's going to win?
There's only one man who can tell you when the election will be. That's the Prime Minister. I can't. I wish I knew.
Your party will win.
I think if we had an election now, the prospects would be very fair.
In other words, you're optimistic. I think that's a good note to end on. Mr. Eden, our time is up. This concludes the latest edition of Meet the Press. And thank you, Mr. Anthony Eden, for your willingness to meet the press.
You've met the press. Now meet Revereware, that line of famous copper-clad stainless steel cooking utensils made by Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated.
Oh, dear, I've been scouring and scouring, and I simply can't get this pot clean.
You'll never have that trouble with Revereware. These copper-clad stainless steel cooking utensils are easy to keep clean. After each use, the shiny stainless steel body is whisked clean in a jiffy. To clean the copper bottom, simply wet it. That's it. Now sprinkle with this Samé Miracle Cleanser and watch closely. While the safe chemical action does its work, then wipe off.
It's a miracle. No tedious scouring. And done so quickly, too. Now I know why they're called kitchen jewels.
Revereware utensils are beautiful enough to hang up where everyone can see them. That's just what most women do. Hang their Revereware on this handy Revere rack. And to keep Revereware sparkling with store-new brightness, apply Sammy Cleanser Dry. Then wipe off. Another edition of Meet the Press also appears on most of these stations every Tuesday evening. The guest Tuesday, September 4th, will be Sir Gladwin Jebb, the permanent United Kingdom representative to the United Nations. Please consult your local newspaper for exact time and channel. This program was a Kinescope recording.
NBC Television.